Speaking today with State Representative Alan Cullen, who represents the 134th District inside Harris County. You are running for your first re-election this year. Tell me, what was your first term like?
For me, my first term was absolutely exciting, challenging, more than I ever thought it would have been, and productive. I mean, it was terrific. I loved it. I loved representing the district. I hope I get back there to do it again.
What would you say was the one thing about it that you completely didn't expect?
For me, okay, I can't vouch for other people. For me, what I didn't expect, quite honestly, was the support I got from both sides of the aisle. From the first time that I went to the back mic, which is, of course, where you ask questions from, not really knowing exactly what I was doing, but knowing that I wanted to ask the questions, but I didn't know how to do it. And then realizing that there was a man standing next to me sort of whispering in my ear about how to do the things, and it turned out later that he's a strong Republican, great guy, and became a good friend of mine. So for me, that was the thing that I just didn't expect. I just, for some reason, thought it would be much more partisan.
Okay. Probably your signature achievement from this session was the Cancer Research Initiative that was on the ballot and that got passed to generate $3 billion in bonds for cancer research. Obviously you're proud of this, but tell me, now that it's passed, what is actually going to happen with it? How is that going to be done?
Well, yeah, I am really proud of it. And I think, Charles, my history. I mean, this November I'll be 39 years as a breast cancer survivor. And my husband's life was extended by 18 years because of the medical center, and he had cancer of the spine. So when I went into this, it wasn't as a political move. It wasn't as a political move first or foremost. I mean, I really went into it for personal reasons, and obviously then realized that the politics of it were really going to help Houston and the Med Center. So those things were important. So that said, what's going to happen now is that the committee has been put together. They're interviewing, and they have a search committee for an executive director of the research and prevention program. And then they will then go out for bids, essentially, for grant requests. And there'll be a separate committee that will review the grants. And my expectations are, because we have the medical center in Houston, the biggest and the best medical center in the world in Houston, my expectations are that we will be putting in for a lot of those grants, and by virtue of the fact that we have so many talented people here, and Houston's the fourth largest state in the United States, and clearly the largest in Texas, we'll probably be the beneficiaries of a lot of that grant money, which will mean that it will not only will it just, whatever happens, save lives, but it's going to attract physicians, pharmaceutical companies, medical personnel to Houston, and so it's going to be good for Houston.
Okay. As I said, that was kind of your signature accomplishment in the first session.
I would add to that House Bill 1751, which garnered $25 million dollars for sexual assault survivors.
Now there's still a challenge to that in court.
There is a challenge to that, but the bottom line is, that was the $5 fee we put on sexual-oriented businesses. The idea being that sexual-oriented businesses that largely employ women, the money raised would go to crimes that largely affect women. But clearly, we know sexual assault affects men and children as well. But some of the money raised would have gone to help defer indigent health care, which would, of course, kept our taxes down. And the sexual-oriented businesses objected to that link between indigent health care and the sexual-oriented business money. And that's what the courts ended up agreeing with. So what we're probably looking at this year is going back and possibly severing those two things. We're not sure, but that's where we may be heading. So that, and maybe dropping that $5, and the money will solely go to sexual assault programs across the state. And then we think that we may still have a challenge, but we think that it won't be as credible as this last one. And in the meantime, they are now collecting money from the sexual-oriented businesses, putting it essentially in escrow until these things are decided upon. So I was probably, I was the author of that bill. In terms of the cancer bill, I was the first House sponsor. I wasn't the author. So I certainly can't take the kind of credit for the cancer bill that others can, that others were involved in it. But I can feel very strongly about 1751 because of my background at the Women's Center. And when this came to me, it seemed to be the way I wanted to go.
Okay. Looking forward to the next session. You know, what would you say your top priorities will be?
Well, 1751 has to be readjusted.
Obviously.
You know, children's health insurance program and other health programs for children have to be, we have to ratchet that up. I think that clearly issues affecting education, I can't say specifically what the bills are going to be yet because that's what we're looking at. But I can say, based on my first session, that the two issues that are most important really are healthcare and education. Healthcare for young people and for everyone. I'm not just talking about children's healthcare, I'm talking about healthcare for everyone in Texas. And education. We are woefully at the bottom of every list when it comes to insured individuals and quality healthcare for all and good education for everyone.
It seems like every time we talk about school finance reform, though, we wind up getting mired in, well, tax cutting.
Mm-hmm.
That was what happened in the last special session where what started out, it seemed, as, you know, a discussion of school finance reform wound up being this, you know, property tax cut plus the new business margins tax.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, my first question is, you know, what are we going to do about school finances? And, well, I'll get to the second question after that. Where are we going with that?
I don't know, Charles. I don't. I mean, I wish I could give you a better answer than that. I think the promises that were made were not as well thought out. I wasn't there for that passage, but were not as well thought out, and maybe even disingenuous. You know, tax cuts on the surface sound good, but if in the end they really don't amount to anything and then you're being taxed on the backside, then something's wrong. So, I'm not sure how we're going to be able to do it, except that the state's going to have to step up. We can't continue to expect the individual districts and all to be able to fund what they need to. It's simply not working.
I mean, one thing that is frequently touted and has been in the legislature many times as a not a solution, at least a revenue source for schools, has been increased gambling.
Yeah.
You know, the slot machines at racetracks or possibly casinos. What's your take on it?
Again, I don't know what the numbers are per se. I've looked at gambling in Texas because I really wanted to see what kind of money it would bring in and what kind of money we're essentially losing by people leaving the state and going other places. And, you know, I lean on the side that the gambling in total may be okay for the state of Texas. I certainly lean on the side that slot machines or whatever we call them, they're not called slot machines, per se.
Yeah, video lottery.
Video lottery,
VLTs,
that's it.
I think it is.
At racetracks, I definitely support that because I've always maintained jokingly, but it's a serious side to that, that when you go to the racetrack, you know, you're not going to see the ballet. I mean, you're going to gamble. So, you know, if you're gambling on a horse, what difference does it make if you're also gambling at a video slot machine in between the races? I mean, I don't see anything wrong with that. And I support that. Now, that's a general question of how I feel about gambling and the video machines. But does that mean that money would be able to support education? I don't know. And I am troubled by the idea that we're going to would try and support education on the banks on the back of gambling. So that's I have to really examine that. I'm just saying that we can raise money by having slot machines at the racetracks. We can raise money, I think, by having gambling in the state. But should that money be earmarked for education? I don't know, because I don't like the way that the lottery worked out and what was promised there. So I have to really study it.
Okay, let's come back to the business margins tax, which a lot of people have been upset about. They say that it's got too many loopholes, that it puts too big a burden on small businesses. Well, while the swap, especially with the property tax cut, gave bigger businesses a much better deal, What do you foresee for the business margins tax? What do you want to see done?
Well, I think there are loopholes, and I'm not trying to opt out of the decision. I just wasn't there on the floor when this whole all the discussion around it was originally put in. That was before my first session. But I think there are a lot of loopholes. One of the things we're doing is we're putting together a group, small group of people from the district, both accountants and small business owners, and bringing them together to say, tell us what you're facing, and tell us what you see as being a reasonable solution. These are the people that are involved with the day-to-day.
Okay. Higher education. A lot of people have been complaining about the cost of public universities in mm-hmm. Texas. As you know, in 2003, the state allowed universities to set their own tuition, and in return, they were given less money up front by the state. Some people have called for the old way to be brought back and tuition to be regulated. What's your take on that?
I believe, from what I've seen so far, that the deregulation of higher ed doesn't seem to be working. Now, you could argue that it's working because universities are pretty well full. They're raising at 100%, 106%. And people are paying it. But the argument on the other side is that there are a lot of people who can't afford to go to university now. They simply can't afford to go. So if you're saying from a bottom line, is it working? Maybe it is, just in terms of the money coming in. Is it? But from the human capital side of it, are people being able to afford to go to university when I think the University of Houston had to go up 106 or 110%? Then I would argue no, it's not working. People simply, it's not as if you can take a part-time job and put yourself through college now.
Okay.
As it may have been when we were younger.
Speaking of the University of Houston, another thing that's come up is a push to have more Tier 1 universities in Texas, and the University of Houston would be on the short list for that. Comment on that?
It's very simple. I support that. I think it's very needed, and I think that it's the right time and the right place to do it.
What if anything, should the legislature be doing to enable U of H to meet the
I think that's something that
qualifications.
I think that's something you have to sit down with Renew Cantor and others and the Higher Education Committee needs to sit down with them and really flush it out and say what can we do to facilitate this happening, and what do you need to do to make that happen? I think those are the people that need to be at the table.
Okay.
The other thing though that I would add to higher education, and one of the issues that I think is going to come up, and that clearly my district cares enormously about, is the top 10% rule. They are not happy with the top 10% rule. They are seeing many of their own students who are 4-point students not being able to get in. Children who are in the 17th percentile, the 21st percentile, for talented artists, scientists, budding mathematicians, who can't get into our state universities and who are leaving the state to go elsewhere, taking our brain drain out. And I think the top 10% rule is clearly stopping people from outside the state coming in. And we need that mixture of people from around the country, around the world, into Texas so that we get classes made up of different people and different thoughts and different ideas. And finally, because of the top 10%, well, we have people who can't get in, because they can't get into state schools here, they can't afford to go anywhere, so they're not even going on to college.
I mean, isn't that something that would be, to some extent, ameliorated by having more Tier 1 universities?
I think that would help. It would help, absolutely. I think the other thing that will help is to make sure that universities like the University of Texas, for example, invest as much financially and in every other form of resource into expanding and raising the profiles of other University of Texas schools around the state. So that when you think of University of Texas, you wouldn't think necessarily of Austin. I mean, maybe that's where you want to go because you want that whole ambiance of the bigger school and maybe the sports activities. But If not, then you would think of the University of Texas in San Antonio. You'd think of the University of Texas elsewhere, because each of those universities have skills and schools that really would provide you with an education that is every bit as good as what you'd find in Austin, maybe better, depending upon what the profile was. So I think what has to, and I think that's proven in the California system, because there are a lot of University of California schools that are good, and it just depends, what do you want? Which school provides the best in the science, or which school is the best in the arts? And so I think the other thing has to be is we have to invest in the in state schools other than, for example, University of Texas Austin.
Okay. Obviously, one of the big storylines that came out of the last legislative session was all of the stuff surrounding the speaker and you know, the challenge over the speakership and what rules he gets to set. You know, obviously, we don't know what the makeup of the House is going to be in 2009, but when you look forward to 2009, what do you see in terms of the speaker's race?
You know, it's funny, Charles. When I was there the first day, you know, I was told that the whole thing would take an hour and a half, and you just get sworn in, elect a speaker, and go for lunch with your family. You know, we were there 7.5 hours because of the speaker's race. So I didn't really, you know, it wasn't until later into the session as things really got heated and people were telling me, you know, it hasn't always been like this. It hasn't always been like this. And I realized how unique this session was. So that said, what does it mean for the next session? Clearly, if the Democrats get 5 seats, then that's going to change the entire picture. If the Democrats get 4 seats or 3 seats, what's that going to say? And what about some of the Democratic D's, and where are they? I think some of them have changed their position. So I haven't been in long enough to be as savvy about some of the votes of my colleagues. But others are clearly aware of who's going to vote which way, and that's what everybody's looking at, because we know, depending on who gets elected, that the day after the election, many of the prognosticators, I'm sure yourself included, will be able to look at who got elected and know whether that person is going to be voting for Craddock or not. And we may face the same thing.
You're a not, is that correct?
I'm sorry?
You are a not voting.
Well, you know, no, you can't put me in any box, because the fact of the matter is, when it came up the first session, the first vote was for whether there should be a confidential ballot or not. That was the issue. And I voted for a confidential ballot, and it lost by 6 votes. Now, that was the signal that Craddock was going to win. Because once that confidential ballot failed, people were not going to be as comfortable voting against him. I voted the way I thought my district wanted me to vote, and I voted for Craddock. So it was either a vote for Craddock or a vote for no one. Once the confidential ballot failed, and, you know, did I vote for Craddock or just do a negative vote? I felt that what was important for me was to, if possible, get placed on the Public Health Committee and Urban Affairs. And the person that does that is a speaker. Once I knew he was going to be speaker, it didn't make sense to put in a negative vote. I wasn't going to help my district by being on the decorating committee or this. I mean, I needed to be on public health. I needed to do what I could for our medical center. I need to be on Urban Affairs. I need to do what I could for Houston. So when you say you're not going to vote that way, I don't know who the players are going to be, and I don't know what the number's going to look like. So I'm going to wait until it all shakes out.
Okay. 2008 is obviously shaping up as a pretty exciting year electorally, both in Harris County, well, and across Texas. I mean, as you're out talking to voters, what are you hearing?
Well, I'm talking almost exclusively in my district, so I can tell you that what I'm hearing is that I have an extraordinarily independent district, and they are voting for people. They really are. I would say that when I block walk on Saturdays between myself and whoever partners with me, usually my sister, we cover probably 60 to 65, 70 houses. And only once, usually, last time, only one person, and generally only one household, you know, opened the door and and when we say who we are, or I say who I am, or she says, and they say, well, what party is a Democrat? I'm a Republican, and that's it. That's happened, you know, one time out of 60-some houses every time we walk, maybe not even once. So what I'm hearing from people is, I'm an independent. I am a Republican. I voted for you last time. You know, I'm open to hearing what the issues are. So I can't say what's happening around the state. I'm so focused on the district and Harris County. And somebody, you know, wiser than I has said, if we look at the numbers and see how many people are out there and prepared to vote, then if those people all come out and vote the way they say they're going to, then it looks like Harris County would turn Democratic.
One of the things that's going on in your district is the eventual construction of the university's light rail line, which is designated for being on Richmond for, you know, a portion of it, and then West Park for a portion of it. Your predecessor opposed the rail line being on Richmond, and there's currently a lawsuit, one that's been tossed but will be refiled over the alignment. I realize this really isn't a state issue, but since it did come up in the 2006 election, I'd like to know, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, this rail line, and what, if anything, do you think you and the legislature should be doing?
Well, I think the legislature itself, as you say, it doesn't have to do with the legislature. The legislature is not involved in deciding where lines go. The legislature is involved in establishing Metro. And I think unless something so incredibly egregious happened, it's not going to reach the level of the legislature. And consequently, because of that, I really have to stay out of it in the first race. I didn't, you know, except for trying to bring people together from both sides and talking about the issues, I really have stayed out of it in terms of my own views. I think the way the line is running right now is the way that Metro has decided it's going to run, the way that City Council is, you know, has basically said, okay, we agree with it. And unless something happens, you know, I'm not going to get involved in it. I really think it's a Metro City issue. I will be more than happy to bring disparate groups together. I'll be more than happy to answer any questions if they appear to be something that the legislature will be involved in. But it's not a legislative issue. We have enough on our plates that, you know, we're not going to get involved in light rail and bus routes in cities across the state of Texas.
Okay. When people go into the voting booth this year and they come to your race, how do you want them to think about, well, you and what you've done?
That's an interesting question, Charles. I want them to get as far down as my race. I want to make sure they get down to the race. That's important on the ballot. I want them to think Ellen has done a good job of representing this district. That she said when she started that she wasn't going to, you know, represent a party to the legislature, that she was going to, you know, that she was going to represent this district to the legislature and not a party to the district. And that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to talk to people. I've tried to hear what they have on their plate, what concerns them. I've tried to be honest in my votes and honest with people. And I've tried to make relationships work up on the legislature, on the floor, so that when it does come to issues, I have credibility amongst my colleagues. And I think I have that same, I hope, and I'd like to have that same credibility amongst my constituents.
Okay. State Representative Ellen Cohen, thank you for talking to me today.
Thank you very much.